What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Halper.
And I'm the other, Matt Taibbi. How are you, Katie?
I'm good, you?
I'm doing well. You know, a lot of people have questions about what happened and why we're no longer Rolling Stone.
We consciously uncoupled from Rolling Stone.
Is that really true, though?
I mean, no, I think
we've been telling people that it was an amicable
break.
But the truth is that it was political.
It was political.
Yeah.
Should I just come clean?
I think you should just admit it.
All right. So,
you know, you cost us both our jobs. So.
I did. I cost us both of our jobs. I created this great opportunity, though, for us to come to Substack. And, you know, a lot of people were calling me an Assadist and calling Matt by extension an Assadist. And I was pretending that, you know, our severing with Rolling Stone or their severing ties with us wasn't related to Syria, but it absolutely was. Okay. Oh my God. It's such a relief to say that. So we had political differences and I wanted to open up a studio in Damascus. I wanted Useful Idiots Damascus. Yeah. I wanted a DT, Damascus Today. They wouldn't even talk about putting into the contract.
And they wouldn't air that glowing profile / interview that you had done with
Bashar al-Assad. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, we basically, all right, I wanted Assad to be the third host.
Right. I thought the chemistry wasn't quite there.
It's off screen. There are a lot of fireworks. But you're right. It just doesn't translate on screen. Like when he and I are hanging out, there's a lot of chemistry and like everyone notices it.
Right.
But it just doesn't work on screen. So, I mean, for Matt, it was a creative difference. With Rolling Stone, I think that maybe they wouldn't have gone on board even if the online chemistry had been more apparent.
Yeah, you know, I thought, you know, that it was just going to be a simple editorial decision for them. Yes, no, probably no.
Yeah, and then I was like, what do you mean? Can you explain? And they're like, if you need us to explain, then that's a problem in itself.
Right.
So, yeah, look, I thought you could have it all as a woman, but I guess not. And if you ask for things and you make demands.
As a Jewish woman.
As a Jewish woman, it is. Apparently, you get shut down and you get your job taken away from you.
Right.
But.
Right.
It turns out that
we're going to do it without Assad anyway. That's a whole other story that we just don't have.
That's a scheduling issue. It's a logistics. It's a COVID. It's a scheduling thing. He is a really bad personal assistant. We'll leave it at that.
Right.
But look, who knows what's going to come next? And we're in talks with other people.
Yeah.
Matt's using his Russia contacts to
exactly. The secret funding of the show is going to continue. We're still going to do Useful Idiots. We're going to do more content. Than we did before. And today is going to be a really interesting show. We have somebody who was a childhood hero of mine, Daniel Ellsberg, the famous whistleblower who brought forth the Pentagon Papers. And we got some new stuff we want to get to. And we got so much to get to, but I think we should just jump right into it.
Yeah, let's jump in. Yeah.
Republicans suck. Democrats suck. Isn't that terrible? Isn't that weird?
Let's start with Democrats suck, okay? Kyrsten Sinema, who's senator from Arizona. She's a Democrat. And she and Manchin were the only Democrats who were holding up the minimum wage, not willing to vote for it. And of course, the beautiful part of this, by the way, Matt, is she's an out bisexual person, which is great. And she likes to pretend she's a feminist. And of course, 2/3 of minimum wage earners are women. Okay, so here, this is really moving, okay? This is Sinema from 2014. She was like in the Green Party. She was like Black Bloc, really radical. In 2014, she tweets, a full-time minimum wage earner makes less than $16,000 a year. This one's a no-brainer. Tell Congress to raise the wage. Next, we have, really beautifully, this is this year on March 8th. She beautifully tweets, Happy International Women's Day, Arizona. Today and every day, I'm grateful for the extraordinary women who paved the way for me and so many others in law and in life, which is also very moving.
Moving.
And then if we go to the next thing. And now here she is doing a thumbs down.
It's not just a thumbs down. She like puts her whole body into it.
A lot of people miss this, but she pats Mitch McConnell on the back.
Really? Nice. I think there's a relationship going on there.
Yeah. If you just go back a few seconds after she pats him on the back, it's really awkward. He really kind of disses her and she does this thing where she turns around and it's like, call me. It's really awkward. It has a lot of Christopher Guest energy. Mm-hmm. She does a little turnaround and then she goes to vote and it's just... It's so unbelievable. Petty. It's so, it's like, it's so teeny bopperish. It's so, yeah, what is she, it's like, she does it like it's a dance, like boo.
Yeah, it's a little like, yeah, I mean, it's like something you're coached to do, like a, I don't know, maybe it's, she's signaling for a fair catch or something in football. I mean, I can't figure it out. It's like, it's, she's got her whole body leaned into it, but that's,
yeah, she's, you know, leaning, I, in, kind of, lean I'm, in feminism, yeah.
I mean, I think that should become a thing in Congress. Like, people should be doing, you know, front handstands and
you
know, back flips to get down there and vote. You know, like sort of a triple.
But it's
axle
like what's weird.
Thing.
Yes, but what's weird and what I like, and I agree with you here. I think that they should do this. It's like they, it's like a very the body imagery, the body language totally contradicts what they're doing. It's like it boo, but they look like they're being really enthusiastic. But I think that every time anyone votes to, like, to cut some programs, they should do, like you were saying, like a handstand. They should do a thumbs down and then do like a, I don't know, a cartwheel, jazz hands, some kind of choreography.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe they should have like a parallel bars up there so that people could do something really elaborate, right?
Like, Jim Manchin needs to do that, right?
You know, like I think that would be really.
What do you
fun.
Think he would do? What do you think? What kind of gymnastics do you think Manchin could best do?
I mean, I think he could do, you know, a bunch of backflips, you know, and
it's a big guy. He could knock into someone though.
Yeah, that could end. That could end badly. He could land on the corner of the speaker's desk there, and it could be, it'd be like a David Lynch movie scene.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing is, you know, I don't know how you feel about this. It's there were a lot of people online who were talking about this, how. Isn't it sort of always convenient how, you know, whenever the Democrats are about to do something significant, they're always kind of slightly held back by some member of the caucus or some sort of small part of the caucus that just decides to bolt and not vote for it. Or it's the parliamentarian or whatever it is. Although, you know, obviously there's a lot in this bill that's pretty interesting, and that was surprising to me that they went as far as they did. So this sucked, though. I mean,
this sucked. Biden could have like done. I mean, all of this stuff. Biden's either inept or he doesn't really want it. They did kind of give the game away when they were like, before the parliamentarian even said anything, they're like, we just don't think the $15 minimum wage thing would pass the parliamentarian.
Right. Yes. Exactly. Not how like we talked to her. Yeah.
Yeah. How would they know it has that?
Not like she's chained in the basement of somebody's townhouse in Georgetown,
right?
Or in a you know, with electrodes in a car battery, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like that.
Not like that. Yeah. And then they were saying it was sexist if you talked about it.
Oh really?
Oh yeah. Her comms person. Yeah. Her comms person. Was
wait,
like,
so you just induced me to talk about this, and now I just performed
sexist,
as sexism?
But don't worry, you can just hide behind me.
Okay.
All yeah, right. her it was like, I said, I stand by what I said. So this is her comms woman. This is a woman who's saying it's sexist to talk about. And can we zoom in on that? So for people who are just listening and not watching, how would you describe this? She's
it's a very happy woman in a motorboat. That's a blue sweater that she's wearing, right? Is that blue?
Let's see. Blue, it's white, it's a baby blue or white sweater. Then she has a nice scarf going on, and it's beautiful water. And then there's like, I think her dog's butt is in the shot. I get why she's saying you can't talk about, because she's saying you can't talk about their body language or the way that they dress. So obviously, I think she needs to recuse herself. She needed to recuse herself though, because if your profile picture on Twitter is you on a motorboat looking like a happy wasp with glasses, you can't make that judgment. It's too, there's a conflict of interest.
The name of that boat is the SS. It's sexist if you criticize Kristen Sinema's thumbs down gesture. There's been a number of initiatives around the country that are now kind of aimed at restricting voting access. This voting restrictions bill passes Georgia House over strong opposition. This is the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The lead reads, a bill to restrict ballot drop boxes, require more ID for absentee voting, and limit weekend early voting days passed the Georgia House on Monday amid protests that the proposals would make it harder for voters to participate in democracy. You know, a lot of times when people complain about these kinds of bills, like, I don't know, sometimes in some cases it's a little bit overblown, but in this case, you know, this whole thing about limiting weekend early voting days, you know, that's, there's a whole tradition in the South of especially Black voters going from church. It's I think they call it souls to the polls. Right. And so what they want to do is they want to eliminate that. And it's so the bill, in addition to like basically making it harder to vote in 19 different ways, is directly aimed, you know, at Black voters. So this is like old school, genuinely old school villainy. The parties are now so openly pissed at each other over the voting issue, and especially the Republicans, obviously. But there's going to be this all out war, I think, to just try to expand the parameters of victory over who gets to have the most access for their voters, right? So there's going to be calls for statehood for Washington, D.C., right, on the Democratic side. And then I think what's going to happen is that the Republicans are just going to do a whole slew of these kinds of laws all over the country. So, you know, there's going to be a generation of this. We should just get prepared for this. Is going to be a never-ending front. You know, and it's almost like a second kind of electoral process.
A second coming.
Yeah, exactly. So what in between actually voting for candidates, the whole question of like who's going to have arranged the voting procedures in their favor in between those votes is now going to become more and more crucial, I think. There's going to be a lot of this at the state level, I think, for the next, you know, for the foreseeable future, because this issue animates Republican voters so much. And I think this is the one area where you're going to be able to see the ongoing influence of Donald Trump, because, you know, there's going to be pressure on state level Republican politicians to do this kind of thing. Like, this is how they're going to fight back, I think.
Yeah.
So.
And at least shout out to remember that during the Supreme Court argument that some Republican lawyer was like, well, we want to do this because we want to win.
You know, these are all tricks that we saw going back to, you know, the Jim Crow.
Jim Crow,
days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, they are traditional Republicans. They like tradition.
But it does suck, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah. Yeah. So bovine besties, cow cuddling becomes popular pastime for those craving a companion after a year of pandemic isolation sees people longing for a warm hug. People head to farms and at the cost of $75 an hour and spend several hours with cows. Participants hug and lean on them with the act of cuddling, known to reduce stress by releasing oxytocin. Cow cuddling is said to be incredibly soothing because the cows are big and have a slower heartbeat. What? There are cuddle farms in New York, Arizona, and Hawaii with many booked in months in advance. Okay, what does the slower heartbeat have to do with it, by the way?
I mean, I think if you're cuddling at a big smelly animal that has a slow heartbeat, it probably chills you out a little bit.
Right. I get it. Yeah. All right. So here we have a guy with a cow. Okay. This now you have a family of, what is this? One, two, three, four people. Very happy. Two cows, four people. It's a good ratio. So this one, how would you describe this?
It's a guy with his arms around a cow, and the cow's got a very emotive face. It could be a bunch of emotions there. It could be anger. It could be happiness. I'm not sure what's going on with that cow.
And the guy is kind of laying on top of other cows. I don't know if he has to pay multiple. Like, do you have to pay per cow or just per hour? Like, why buy the cow when you can have the cow's friends for free?
It looks like one of the cows has kind of got a nose going on, like, in the guy's butt area.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Uh-oh. Which might be part of the pleasurable charm? Expression on his face. I'm not sure what's going on there.
Just he does look kind of in love with one of the cows. Classic, yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is almost dangerous. It looks like a cow fell asleep on a teenager, and it looks like he could kill him any moment.
It looks like the kid passed out drunk.
Yeah, looks like they're both drunk, passed out on each other. They're going to wake up in the morning and be like, this is awkward. What happened last night?
Nothing.
Nothing. Yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah, I'll call you. Yeah.
Talk later. Yeah, his face is red too. They did a lot of drinking. I mean, the human's face. That is a cute. I don't know what that is. That looks like Never Ending Story. Buffalo. Yeah, it's a bit, let's see. That looks like she's wrestling. Some of these look like they're wrestling with the cow. Like, I don't know if there's a lot of consent in this one.
Yeah, I mean, there's no consent in any of it, is there?
No, right. You're right. Yeah.
I guess the cows are nuzzling, not hugging.
Yeah, they are nuzzling. I guess they don't look like they're in, like they're suffering.
I mean, it could be worse from a cow's perspective.
Yeah, they're they're alive.
Participants often become emotional during the activity, with some even vowing to become vegetarian. I could see that.
Oh, this is good PR for them. Oh, this is a good one. There's a drooling cow. That's really cute. That looks like a human. Kind of looks like a human. He looks like he's annoyed. He's like,
it looks
this
like
again?
Chris Christopherson.
Oh, yeah, it does look like Chris Christopherson.
Even the drool.
Even the drool, yeah. That really does look like they're dating. Like, it has a lot of selfie, like, Instagram energy.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I'm just saying.
It's a tad creepy.
Yeah, it's that creepy, yeah. It's also very unflattering.
Is that a selfie stick thing?
I don't know, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, the nose is a bit prominent there. Yeah. I don't know, yeah. It's
a booger. Is that a booger? That's rude. You got to post flattering photos.
Yeah.
At least I could do it. Anyway, so, I mean, I'm lucky I have Bodhi, but you know what? I get it. I didn't get it before because I was like, well, why not just, like, cuddle with your puppy? But that you can't do that. You can't lie on a puppy. That's not safe. The puppy, obviously. That would be great to have a big dog.
A cow-sized dog.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Like, if this is still going on 10 years from now and there's no COVID and there's, like, massive hugging parties with cows, I guess that's all right.
I guess we can't knock it until we've tried it.
Yeah, we can't knock it. I mean, as long as it doesn't go too far.
Right.
Right. Yeah, I'm all for it. Are you for it?
Yeah, I'm for it, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, it's still weird, though.
It's still weird, yeah.
All right. So this is a story about, it's actually, I picked it up because it's two Russian crime news story cliches packed into one. Basically, there's two kinds of news stories you see constantly in these Russians are really big into, like, sort of crime news. There used to be a number of different newspapers there that were just sort of gruesome crime stories, and people read them. And we had a section in our newspaper over there that was devoted to this. And the two constant forms of news stories were horrible serial killers who did unthinkable things. That was like one genre that was pretty prominent there. Like, the Russians and the Americans are the world leaders in producing serial killers.
Oh, wow.
Probably because we're the most militarized country. You know, I talked to a famous psychiatrist over there, this guy, Alexander Bukhanovsky. If you've ever seen the movie Citizen X, he's the guy, the character that inspired the Max von Sydow character. That was his theory, is that because we had so much violence sort of built into our society, that's why we both produce serial killers. So there's we have lots of serial killers in Russian. That's maniac, right? It's these horrible stories. And then the other one, which
maybe
is
it's also because we're both very industrious peoples.
Could be that too,
right?
We got a lot of grit, like picking ourselves up by our bootstraps kind of a thing, right? Yeah. Like that sort of self-reliance history. The other one is one that Russian detectives joke about all the time, which is that it doesn't take a lot of detective skills to be a detective in a lot of Russian crime cases, because half of the murders are when you show up in somebody's house and it's a bunch of dudes who are passed out drunk in the kitchen, and one has stabbed the other or chopped up the other. So this is the Reese's Pieces of the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup.
I was going to say pieces. Yes,
right, pieces, exactly. Yeah. It's about Eduard Selezniov, who is the...
I think you kind of have to read the headline.
Yeah, the headline is Monster Cage, Cannibal Killer Chopped Up Three Pals When They Were Passed Out Drunk and Ate Their Body Parts. So this guy's from Arkhangelsk, which is way the hell up north of St. Petersburg. A cannibal killer who murdered his three friends, boiled their corpses, and ate their body parts has been jailed for life. Eduard Selesnyov, 51. Just like me.
Oh, my God. No wonder you identify with this story.
Yeah, maybe that's what it was. From Arkhangelsk, Russia, was convicted of killing his friends after a court heard how he stabbed the men to death after they passed out from drinking too much booze. Definitely doesn't look like a serial killer at all.
Yeah, I feel like we need to explain. This is like, how do you explain what he looks like? It's...
Well, he's got the quintessentially Russian beard. Right.
Yeah, he looks like Kevin Bacon, first of all. I'm not convinced it's not Kevin Bacon. We can play the Kevin Bacon game with him.
6 degrees of seven of Kevin Bacon without Eduard Selesnyov.
Right? It looks like he's a Kevin Bacon who's been aged, even though he's probably the same age as that, right? But like he's like crust, he's like a, what color would you describe that as? Like a lemon?
What, his hair?
No, his face. It's like an egg.
Yeah.
It's like it has the quality. It looks like the outside of an egg, the egg white.
It's a little yolky. Yeah. Oh, I see. Oh, you're saying it's like an
egg
white.
No, you're right. It's yolk. It is. It's like if you combine them.
Yeah.
And then the hair looks like it was chopped off with an axe or something.
Well, that's very Russian too. Gogol used to say with Russian faces, it's one swipe of the axe and then there's a nose and then
I didn't know that.
Eyes gouged out with a great drill. That was Russian faces are sort of rough hewn. But it also he's got the beard that has a beard. That's another great northern look, right? Love it. Anyway, it goes on. He admitted during the trial that he boiled his friends' bodies and used their cooked remains as food. His victims, age 59, 43, and 34, were sliced up to remove the body parts he wanted to feast on before the rest of the remains were dumped in a local river.
Very sustainable, by the way. Not good practice.
Yeah. And
you got to eat the whole carcass. It's only justifiable if you eat the whole body.
Right. Yeah. If you're going to go to that length, you got to at least respect the animal. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of Russian men, if there are any out there in the audience, would probably agree that they understand exactly what happened here, because when Russian dudes get drunk in the kitchen, there reaches a moment in there's two things that always happen in these scenes. One is that they run out of vodka and they have to go out and get more. And usually there's a misadventure between that moment and when they get back. And the second thing is at some point someone gets really, really hungry and they want to eat pelmeni, which is like sort of like a ravioli type thing. So I'm guessing what happened is they reached the pelmeni point and there just wasn't any. And so he improvised.
Yeah.
That's what I'm guessing happened.
I mean, it's good. He's good in the kitchen. That's
right,
kind of feminine. Yes. How many Russian men know how to put a meal together?
They know how to cook something up when they're drunk.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's a skill that definitely all Russian men have. Yeah. They know how to do almost anything drunk, actually.
Right.
They could probably fix a submarine.
Yeah.
But anyway, the court heard that Selesnyov's bizarre eating habits also included cooking local cats and dogs, as well as birds and other small animals found on the streets. The serial killer sliced up the remains of his friends and selected the cuts of meat he wanted to eat.
He's discerning.
Yeah, that's right. He wanted to eat only the best of choices parts. Yeah, this is just sad. He even moved into the apartment belonging to one of his victims and told the man's parents that their son had gone to work in another city. That's a little bit American Psycho, remember?
Yeah. Now, this is where it gets ugly.
Yeah.
I was okay with the story so far.
Yeah.
Until I did that.
So, told the same story to police officers who started a missing person investigation. Yeah, at this point, it just becomes gross.
He is in another city. He's in... in St. Petersburg.
That's right.
Working in computer tech IT. What's a very Russian job?
I don't know. He's working as a taxi driver.
Working Uber. Taxi system.
Yeah.
He says hello. He'll call you. Don't call him.
That's right. That's right. Anyway, I don't know. We just like to talk about cannibals and either eating people or having sex with dead people on this.
It's a family podcast.
It's a family show. So this was eating people. They didn't have.
It falls into that. Yeah.
We didn't have any necrophiles.
No, I think that's a pretty good. That's. I mean, there's a lot to it. You got cooking. You got. I mean, I don't know how I feel about the rats. Why? I mean, if he's discerning enough to cut certain parts out, why would you go and eat a rat?
Yeah, I mean, I guess at a pinch. Right? There's nothing else handy.
You just add a pinch of salt, pinch of pepper, and a pinch, yeah. Yeah, I guess so, yeah. What all is right. it? I mean, the bird I could see. I mean, I don't like that. It's gross, but I little quail, like I could see that, but.
Cats doesn't do it for you?
No.
Right.
I've never, no. Do people, no. Ugh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look, if you're living in a neighborhood and cats are going missing and you got a guy with a beard like that in the neighborhood, I think that's.
Kill him.
That's where your detective skills come in.
Right. Just kill him. Are we just telling people preemptively to?
Yeah, preemptively. Yeah, don't.
At least
investigate.
Yeah, just handcuff him.
Right, right. Just go straight to the end. Yeah. All right. So that was terrible, I think.
Yeah. During the campaign, there were a lot of stone moments, and we had a segment doing that. And just because Biden's not running anymore doesn't mean there aren't stone moments.
I just want to thank you both, and I want to thank the former general, I keep calling him general, but the guy who runs that outfit over there. I want to make sure
the Pentagon,
the secretary, for all he's done to try to implement what we just talked about and for recommending these two women for promotion. Thank you all. May God bless you all and may God protect our troops.
This is another clip.
We have two urban farms, actually, in our building. We have Mary, who's in the garage there, and then we have Cultivate the City.
And the point here is that his garden. They're going to freak out, his handlers.
You're not going to be able to see it from here, but if they want to give a wave.
I see him.
Yeah. And then we also have
don't
solar.
Jump. We need you.
Don't jump. We need you.
What?
Let's go.
Thank you guys. Thanks so much.
So they freaked out.
What?
I guess. Can you play? Play that again. This is more. This is very strong. Christopher Guest, the guy who died. What's his name? Fred Willard. He makes a joke. I guess someone's like standing up above, and he goes, "Don't jump."
I see him.
Yeah. And then we also have
don't solar. Jump. We need you.
Don't jump, we need you. And then they start going. Anyway, it's so weird and overwhelming. And it really needs that Curb Your Enthusiasm song, music in the background when it zooms in on him.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we got to do that, yeah.
Yeah, don't jump. We need you. Is there actually a person up there or not?
Oh, maybe that was it.
There's
nobody up there. I think he did say it was a plant. Actually, was he talking? I think that's what. That's no wonder that they were like so freaked out. He was talking to a plant. I mean, it's better than Clint Eastwood.
Don't jump. We need you.
Cactus.
Don't do it, buddy.
Freeze. I'm glad you're at least you're stopping and you're considering it. You're not. I'm glad you're not jumping. You're pausing. Yeah, it's really funny.
I mean,
so
we're laughing, but the Biden losing his faculties thing is going to become increasingly.
It's kind of a thing.
Serious.
Yeah,
it's becoming a thing.
Despite that, there's a piece in the Washington Post opinion. Comedians are struggling to parody Biden. Let's hope this doesn't last. So. He's really worried that there's nothing to make fun of him over. But I love the idea that, according to this article, it's like a struggle to do that.
To parodize Biden?
Yeah.
I mean, they should just do... I mean, like
just show him on screen. That's why it's hard, because it's like you can't make it up.
So, like, when Gerald Ford was president and Chevy Chase just fell down a lot because Gerald Ford was just ridiculous... Right. That's all you have to do is just have somebody be like, you know, ridiculous, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. But Biden so far has been impregnable. The voice is too bland and devoid of obvious quirks and beyond the occasional, come on, man. His conversational manner, what, the verb choice?
His voice is too, just the idea that there's nothing there to
work
with.
I know. Yeah, his conversational manner too muted and self-effacing to give the parodist much to work with. Trump supporters and Fox News pundits would undoubtedly attribute this to the media's liberal bias. And to be sure, Trump was viewed by the mostly liberal satirists not just as an irresistible comic target, but also as a dire threat to the nation. Biden's pleasantly boring presidency has been a welcome return to normality, but hardly great material for parody. Let's hope, like, it's the only terrible thing about his returning us to normal is that it doesn't give us as much comedic potential. Let's hope that changes. Can we really survive 4 years with a president who doesn't have a vivid enough profile to make the cold open of Saturday Night Live? Can't Joe Biden, in between planning for immigration reform and an infrastructure bill, offer a new conversational tick or catchphrase? Malarkey went out with the debate season. A verbal gaffe would be helpful, but Biden has set a modern record for getting this far into his presidency without holding a press briefing. Impressionists need something to latch onto. It's either that or 4 years of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Come on, man. Your legacy is at stake. I mean,
it's amazing. The Washington Post can't tell the truth even about this.
I know. I mean, I think that we should every week we should send them like comedic material. We should do a comedy packet based on Biden's behavior.
Here's something you can work with.
Yeah.
Maybe there was nobody. Maybe Biden was talking to a cactus in that hardware
store. Yeah. Or he definitely forgot the name of the Pentagon guy.
Right. Or the Pentagon. He's running the whole show, that outfit over there.
That's hilarious.
You mean the Defense Department? Biden at this point is the Lloyd Bridges character in Hot Shots.
Admiral.
Good to see you again, sir. It's been too long.
And so it has. Yes, yes.
How are you, sir?
Hawaii. Oh, in Hawaii? God damn it, Bill. I'm supposed to be in California.
No, sir. This is California.
Well, gotta run. Good luck.
So that this brings us to the serious portion of the show.
So excited to have on Daniel Ellsberg today.
Yeah, Daniel Ellsberg, a major historical figure in a couple of ways. He was a huge reason for the I think for the change in American consciousness about the history of the Vietnam War, because he was the whistleblower who gave us the Pentagon Papers. The Pentagon Papers detailed four presidencies worth of lies about the Vietnam War. Presidents dating back all the way through Eisenhower had presented a false front to the public about what was going on in Indochina. And Ellsberg, who had a long history of seeing through a lot of the big deceptions of the Vietnam era, including the Gulf of Tonkin incident and some other things, he basically brought all this out in public and really changed the way the public thought about the entire history of the war. But also people forget this. Indirectly, he was the reason that the Nixon presidency ended. Right. Richard Nixon essentially formed his infamous plumbers unit. And one of the first things they did was break into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office. So he set kind of two really big, important historical events in motion, one intentionally, one unintentionally.
And he was tried under the Espionage Act, much like
Julian Assange. Yes, though not convicted. And he's written some amazing books, a book called Secrets that he wrote in the early 2000s about his history with the Pentagon Papers and in Vietnam. And then more recently, Doomsday Machine, which is about nuclear weapons and the sort of continuing threat that people seem to not pay as much attention as they should to.
Yeah, and really recommend his website, Ellsberg.net, because there are tons of really cool primary sources there. So definitely go there.
We're going to talk to him about all these things, and it should be a great conversation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Daniel Ellsberg, thank you so much for coming on Useful Idiots. Welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Mac.
Well, obviously, it's a great honor for us to have you on. Big fan of your books. I want to talk about all of them, but I think we should start with Doomsday, which is your latest.
Doomsday Machine,
yes. Why have people stopped caring about the nuclear weapons issue with the same intensity that they once did? I mean, it's not like it's any less important than it ever was. In fact, you could argue that it's more important with the accumulation of accidents and near misses over the years. What is it in your experience that you think is the reason for people not caring as much?
Well, I think it goes back really 30 years to the end of the Cold War. People thought, okay, we're not in a life and death struggle with the communist menace anymore. There's no more problem. And so they thought the problem went away. The trouble is the weapons did not go away. They're being renewed. In fact, I see even this week as we talk, there's a controversy, which will probably end the wrong way, on whether to build new ground-based ICBMs, what they call strategic missiles, and to replace our Minuteman missiles. Now, as you may have seen in the book, I regard those land-based missiles, which are very vulnerable, and if there's tactical warning that an enemy attack is on the way, as there has been falsely a number of times in the past, the president has a few minutes to decide whether to lose those missiles or to launch them, use them or launch them. And in other words, those missiles are the hair trigger on the doomsday machine. The world would be very much safer if we eliminated our own ICBMs, and still safer still if the Russians got rid of theirs. But actually just getting rid of ours would make the world a lot safer. Instead of that, we're going to spend $250 billion over the next many years maintaining these things, $100 billion at the start, to replace these with new modernized ICBMs. We should be willing to spend that amount of money to get rid of them. They're such a danger. And yet instead, the likelihood is that they're going to produce those. Why? Because I just read this morning. Northrop Grumman, which is producing those missiles, has spent $119 million in the last 2 years alone to lobby for those missiles. There is no other reason than the Northrop Grumman lobbying to get those missiles. There's no military, no strategic reason, but that's enough. You know, it means jobs in districts all over the country. It means votes, union support for those jobs, above all, campaign donations, and probably direct bribes in various ways to politicians for it. That's enough to get it. And that maintains a threat that's as dangerous as it has ever been. And that goes back 60 years.
There's a really interesting part of the book where you talk about how well, people say, oh, they've only used nuclear weapons twice. Yeah. And you say, no, that's not true. They've been used many times, in the fashion that you might sort of point a gun at somebody. Could you talk a little bit about the point you were trying to make there?
Well, that's the analogy that I've used for many, many years. Mm-hmm. When you point a gun at somebody's head in a confrontation, you are using the gun. If you get your way without pulling the trigger, that's, for most people, the best, for most gun bearers, the best use of the gun. Some may like to pull the trigger, but that's, after all, more risky. You have the gun in order to use it in that way, and we have used our nuclear weapons not only continuously for half a century to keep our place in West Berlin by threatening to blow up Eurasia and really the whole world in terms of human population. If Russians moved into West Berlin, and by the way, that worked. The Russians could easily have moved into West Berlin, and the only way we could have stopped them, we couldn't stop them with conventional force. They had 22 divisions in the vicinity of West Berlin. We couldn't get through that. But we could threaten to blow up the world. Blowing up the world is a little exaggeration. Actually, with nuclear winter, you wouldn't. That doesn't lead to the extinction of the human species. Only about 90%. Only is ridiculous, of course. 90 to 98%. That leaves 70 million, 170 million people left. That's quite a few.
Not a total loss, then.
But seven, yeah, right. No, they'll be there to do it all over again, over time.
But, you have to see the planet as half full, not half empty.
Actually, there was an article recently. There's a new book out about precipice. We're at the precipice. What puts us at the precipice? And the author says the only things worth looking at are things that lead to possibly total extinction. And since nuclear war and even climate is not in that category, he kind of pushes that aside. Well, that's asinine. And we're really talking about the ability we have paid for, deployed, produced, had at the ready all these years, really, for, as I say, since a sizable number of weapons came about by 1950. That's 70 years ago. It's the ability to kill most people on Earth. No country should have such an ability. It should not exist in the hands of any, but it does exist in the hands of the U.S. and Russia. And if testing is continued, as Republicans have pushed for a long time, then a number of the other seven countries with nuclear weapons will get a doomsday capability too. In other words, it's a kind of mass insanity, the capability for which we're seeing very vividly this year, are we not, in the last year? In other words, a very large number of people believe that more votes were cast for Trump in the swing states than for Biden, 80% of the Republicans. So mass delusions are possible. How about there's no real pandemic, the numbers are exaggerated, there's no climate change. Look at how many people, Republicans primarily, are able to believe these delusions for a long time. Well, I'm saying that our nuclear posture has been based on such delusions for more than half a century, and still is.
When I was reading the book, I was like, I realized like I didn't even know what a nuclear winter was. I had a vague sense of what it was, and I think it's a generational thing. Could you explain that for other listeners?
Thank you. You're right. Of course, you're right. That needs explaining. You know, in my generation, when I got into this back in 1958, 59, 60, no one understood that there was such a possibility. That wasn't true. They didn't learn it until about 1983 under Reagan, when scientists like Carl Sagan and a bunch of others, Russians, Tinchikov, Toon, Brian Toon, others, realized that cities burning from a nuclear strike causing a firestorm, which is, by the way, a peculiar kind of fire that we only achieved deliberately.
Dresden.
Three times. You know the other times? You're right. Dresden, Tokyo, and Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. And Hiroshima proves that with a nuclear weapon, you can get it every time. And the point of a firestorm is it has to be widespread, simultaneous fires, hard to achieve with just incendiary weapons. It happened in Dresden and Tokyo. But widespread, simultaneous fires creates an updraft, a very strong updraft that brings winds in. It creates its own weather. It brings winds, a low volume, a low pressure zone that brings winds in to the area, creating very high heats on the ground. It's like a bellows in a furnace, creating very high heats, which kills everyone in that area, either asphyxiates them from loss of oxygen or burns them to death. But something that wasn't even noticed with Tokyo and Hiroshima, it creates an updraft that carries smoke and soot into the stratosphere, which doesn't happen otherwise. It stays in the lower atmosphere, and it dissipates, and it gets rained out. But from these firestorms, the nuclear weapons, we learned 40 years ago, almost, the updraft into the stratosphere carries it into an area where it doesn't get rained out. And it gets moved by winds around the Earth in days, in a week or two, covering the Earth with a pall of smoke that cuts out about 70% of the sunlight. And that means that you get winter-like conditions, ice age conditions, on the Earth all the time, spring, summer, night. Freezes rivers, freezes lakes, but above all, kills vegetation, kills all the harvests. So what it means is that in a nuclear war, let's say with Russia and China, or Russia and the U.S., possibly China, but Russia and the U.S. definitely, you would get an effect that condemns about 90%, maybe larger, of the population to starvation within about a year. The stocks of food last about 60 days in the globe. And they're unequally distributed. We have a lot. We would stop sending it to anybody else, but ours would run out within a year as well, too. Everybody starves. It's not, by the way, the death that people imagine from a nuclear explosion at ground zero. Very nice. You never know what happens. No.
If only.
This is a slow, slow death where you watch your children starve first and the old people. And like radiation, except that it's all around the world, the Southern Hemisphere as well. Okay, we discovered that in 1983. Gorbachev, who learned it even earlier from his Russian scientist, Sinchukov, and Reagan took that, surprisingly Reagan, took that even very seriously, and they talked about eliminating nuclear weapons for an hour or two, a couple hours, till people like Richard Pearl and others in the American delegation brought them down to Earth. The only time that I know of that two heads of state have talked about elimination, which together they could do. In fact, Biden and Putin, even Trump, who was more friendly with Putin than Biden, could have imaginably had such a discussion, to say the least, whether their military-industrial complexes, and there's one in Russia too now, capitalist country just like ours, they have their Northrop Grumman's, if they would let them do it, if Putin could have overridden them in some way, you could imaginably get to that. That's what should happen. But it's not in the course of happening. The military-industrial complex in each country and in the other countries as well, the lesser countries, gets too much profit and too much political power from the status quo. And the status quo is one of risking the imminent death of, see, it's hard to say, civilization. 70 million people left and have civilizations of a kind, not like ours, 170 more. All humans? No, no, you'd have some left. But imagine a world in which 7 billion people have died either immediately or within weeks from radiation or within a year. And what that leaves, it gives us a look at human species that has tolerated this, that has built this, that has threatened this, that is not very encouraging.
Yeah, you say in the opening of your book, you say that you are trying to awaken audiences of Americans and others to the substance of what I then wanted to reveal, precisely because I do not believe it is just history. Tragically, I believe that nothing has fundamentally changed. So is there any hope, especially given that the power of the military industrial complex, how can this actually be, how can we be veered off that course towards nuclear annihilation?
It'll take a miracle. Fortunately, miracles do happen. In 1983, that same year that I was talking about where they discovered that, how many people, what would people have said was the likelihood that, well, this is again before your time and before your generation.
Not mine, but
yeah. Well, what was the likelihood that the Berlin Wall would come down in 89? You know, even people who were, say, 10 at the time, like, or whatever, like that, my son, were pulled in front of the TV by their parents. Maybe you had that condition, Matt, and said, watch this. Something incredible is happening. And really, the probability people would have given to that was not low. It was zero. It was impossible. That wasn't going to happen, but it did happen. And Nelson Mandela becoming, without a violent revolution, becoming the head of state in South Africa, that was impossible. So, in fact, this is actually little known, but to me, the chance the nuclear war, the Vietnam War, would end in 1975, while before Nixon's second term had ended. The war wasn't going to end with Nixon in office. He got a landslide in 72. The fact, from my perspective, not that of the public in general, but from what I knew, the chance then that the war was going to end before 77, before he was out of office, was zero. It was out of the question. How about the chance that Nixon, with his landslide, would be out of office in 74? Unthinkable. You know, just you couldn't imagine that. It did happen. And the war did end 9 months later after it got out. So with a lot of people in each of these cases, working towards something that looked impossible. They all helped, and the impossible happened. That's not maybe giving you as much hope as some people would, but that's where my hope is, and it's real. I think it's extremely unlikely, let's put it this way, in the climate case, how likely is it that Exxon will leave all of its oil reserves in the ground and not burn them? We're now going, I don't see a way that that comes about. How do we challenge Exxon and Chevron and Aramco and British Petroleum to an extent that they write off those assets as they should for a few years? You know, that they should be out of that business. Well, not very likely. And if it isn't, as you know, climatic catastrophe lies ahead. And yet, it is. Is it not worth working in that direction? It is. And we'll see what happens.
Is part of the problem that the public is just not, and you wrote about this in your book, Secrets, how everybody has this idea that nothing stays secret in Washington forever, that everything always eventually ends up in the New York Times. But the reality is that a huge number of nuclear accidents and near misses have been effectively kind of kept from the public, and that there actually is an ability of governments to keep secrets quite effectively. Are people just not as afraid as they should be because they don't know about a lot of the things that have happened? I mean, we've had fires involving warheads and warheads that were crushed. We had two very serious near misses in the Soviet Union. Is that part of the problem, the secrecy?
Well, yes, definitely. You're right. They have kept those secrets. You can pry them out of them bit by bit, often with Freedom of Information Act, which, by the way, should be expanded enormously instead of contracted the way it has been time after time. With all the shortcomings of the Clinton administration, which I saw, they had one good, there was one good characteristic. They really did release a lot of information under Freedom of Information Act. They expanded it. We learned an enormous amount we hadn't before. That was closed down by almost all of the succeeding administrations. You could put more people to work declassifying documents. Look, just today in the New York Times, I noticed that the French are confronting the question of declassifying documents from 50 years ago. They're being withheld, looked at document by document, instead of just saying it's all. Actually, there was a law saying that anything 50 years ago should be declassified, period, in bulk. Should be a lot shorter than that, a lot shorter than that. But they haven't been doing it. They've been looking document by document, so forth. Now, that covers the Algerian War. And it covers torture in the Algerian War. So there are people, historians, who want to look at those records. The same thing, by exactly, applies here. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee, after some controversy arose over our use of torture in the so-called war against terror. So Cy Hirsch reveals Abu Ghraib, basically, the tortured Abu Ghraib, others. And there was something of a discussion of it at that point. The Senate, then, Intelligence Committee under Dianne Feinstein, did a huge staff study that resulted in 6,000 pages looking at every single case of torture that they had, and revealing, according to the small summary they released, revealing that no actionable intelligence had come out of that, exclusively out of that torture program. You know, really giving substance to the statement you hear, but it is implausible. Torture doesn't work. It's not a good policy. It is, by the way, as illegal as anything in the world. It's what's called, use Kogan's peremptory international law. No legislature can make it legal. And our domestic legislature has criminalized it. The UN Charter, the Convention of Human Rights, everything, it's illegal as it can be. So we were doing it. And this page report remains classified. Feinstein couldn't get it out. She's head of the Intelligence Committee. Now, she could have, of course, just put it out in the Senate. But then you'd never get any information from CIA again. They wouldn't give it to you. Just like Fulbright chose not to put out the Pentagon Papers that I gave him. He could have done it perfectly legally, but then the Pentagon would say, oh, we can't trust you to keep secrets. And they would have given they would have given control of foreign military aid to armed services, which is very pro-Pentagon, rather than the Foreign Relations Committee. So he didn't put it out, period, having said to me that he would earlier. Well, likewise, this torture report, people like Wyden or Udall who said, we should know this. Feinstein said, this absolutely, we've redacted it already. It can be put out, absolutely. CIA said, no, it's still not out. If I'd been in, that is one of the things, definitely. I would have been willing to go to prison to get out. It's a historic document to try to put a nail, a stake in the heart of this, what is it, the...
Yeah, the vampire.
Vampire. Yeah. It's not a vampire squid. It's a...
just a regular vampire.
It's a regular vampire. And but it's not there. It's still with it.
They made that movie, The Report, about it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there is the report. It's sitting... By the way, the Pentagon after that, under George W. Bush... it was in his second term, I guess. They tried to get it back so they could burn it, you know, get it out. But studies do exist. Yes, and it should be out. But as you say, Matt, secrecy has worked very well on nuclear. For example, I'll just mention this, Katie. You rightly reminded me that people don't know what nuclear winter is. And I say it's the winter caused by the smoke that rises and covers the earth and creates ice age conditions. Okay. Actually, I know very well that people, I've asked audiences this time and again, don't really know the difference between an A-bomb and an H-bomb. The difference between a so-called atomic bomb, a uranium fission bomb of the kind we used on Hiroshima, and the kind that are almost universal today, H-bombs, hydrogen bombs, fusion bombs that fuse light isotopes of hydrogen. The important difference being that the hydrogen bomb, when it first was tested, was 1,000 times more powerful than the A-bomb that hit Hiroshima, which is either 13,000, that's 1,000 times more powerful than the largest blockbuster of World War II. It was 15 to 20 tons. And they were called blockbusters because they destroyed a block of buildings. Okay. The Hiroshima bomb in one bomb is 1,000 times more powerful than that, 15, 20 kilotons. The Hiroshima was 15. The first test of a nuclear droppable hydrogen bomb, 1954, was 1,000 times more powerful than that, 1,000,000 times more than a blockbuster. Nearly all of our bombs, they're not that big normally. You don't need them that big. They have a lot of smaller ones that does have a bigger destructive effect. And it doesn't all go up in the air. It destroys things around. Unfortunately, it throws a lot of smoke up in the atmosphere. Okay. Several countries, India, Pakistan, have not tested an H-bomb yet. India is thought to have tested one that fizzled, that didn't work. New testing, which the Republicans have been for we start testing, everybody starts testing, will give them H-bombs as well. What I've been saying is hardly anybody in our country would understand what difference that made. So they have A-bombs. They have bombs before, now they have bombs. It's the difference between destroying cities and destroying a hemisphere, or basically with nuclear winter. They become doomsday machines. So it makes a big difference. But hardly anybody knows that that's what's riding on that. So we're living in a world of, it's like believing that there's no climate problem. And most people manage to believe that if their president tells them that and their Republican congressmen tell them that.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, because there's a striking scene. Again, it goes back to your other book, Secrets, where you're recounting the Gulf of Tonkin incident. And the whole story is so crazy. You very dramatically recount how you're hearing all the reports come in from Captain Herrick in the Gulf of Tonkin, and then you know there are torpedoes in the water, and it's all very dramatic. And all of a sudden, there's another series of reports that basically says, "Oh, all those things that we said before, we're not so sure about now. Maybe we should investigate." And I went back and looked at the actual news reports the next day, and there were, it was, you know, it's absolutely unequivocal that there were there was an attack. You know, the New York Times headline, Reds driven off. It's just so striking how completely they lied about that episode. And in the book, you say that, you know, you think probably not much has changed on that score. How much should people be concerned about what their presidents tell them? And should they always be skeptical, particularly when it comes to matters of war?
Yes.
Well, that's an easy question, I guess.
Somebody told me the other day, Dan, I've never heard you give a yes or no answer. And I said, oh,
there you did.
It's been a while just to throw a fastball here or something. Yeah. Oh, yes, of course, skeptical. I.F. Stone, the very good reporter, investigative reporter, used to say, all government official lies, lie. All government officials lie. And nothing they say is to be believed. And that's true. It doesn't mean that everything they say is a lie and that there's no information value at all in what they're telling. So the information value is mainly, this is what he wants she or wants me to believe at this moment for some reason, a particular audience, me. What he says for another audience is what they want them to believe. But in the government, when you discuss these things, what should we say about this? If anybody said, well, the truth is, people would say, what's that person doing in this room? You don't start from that. You can always do better than the truth. You know, you can hide certain things, keep people from noticing, keep people from asking questions. You can always do better than that. So essentially, everything they say is to some degree misleading. It's not always flatly true, but it's, you know, what the magician does, misdirection. Look in this direction, you know, rather than other. And yes, great. You can't overdo the criticism of that. And yet, of course, I said you can't overdo it. I guess QAnon does overdo it. You can see conspiracies even where they don't exist. That's for sure, if you're told about them, especially authoritatively. But the truth is, conspiracies do exist at the highest level. I was part of a massive conspiracy to get us into the Vietnam War. I knew what was happening. I knew the public was being lied to. I kept my mouth shut about it. I didn't have to say a lot of lies because I didn't speak to the public particularly. But everything the president and McNamara and the others were saying was false. And I went along with that, as did hundreds and hundreds of other people. So when I mentioned that to the other day, and they said, well, this person who's very hip said, well, I wouldn't call that a conspiracy. And I said, well, why not? And he said, well, a conspiracy means people deceiving, covering up. I said, yes, that's what we're talking about here. And, you know, look at Iraq, you know, 40 years later. So he said, well, it doesn't seem right. I said, you find it hard to imagine a conspiracy led by the president. And I think people do. You know, they think it's somebody, bad guys under the president or, you know, not in the government. But really, conspiring is what they do in the government. When it comes to managing an empire, while you're telling everybody that we are not an empire and we don't act like empires, and actually we are an empire and we do act like empires. And the big difference between us and other empires in the past is that we have a nuclear gun to point at people. We are the empire that invented the idea of getting our way by threatening to blow up most people on Earth. And keep in mind, before 1983, we didn't think in terms of blowing everybody up. The Southern Hemisphere would be fairly safe from fallout, for example. We didn't think about smoke at all. But Eurasia was going to go. If we went to war with Russia over Berlin, for example, which even Kennedy said, we won't do this unless we have to, but we won't shrink from it, you know, if we have to. Shrink from what? From nuclear war with Russia. In fact, the head of the Strategic Command, Admiral Charles Richard, said about a month ago, we have to be prepared for nuclear war with Russia and China. Now, China has 10% of the weapons we do, but still enough to cause nuclear winter. We have 10 times more. Nuclear war with Russia, so we have to be prepared to kill 90% of the human population if we have to. You know, he doesn't, has he thought about what he's saying? He knows what that war is. It's just that we've gotten used to saying things like that over the years. And it is a bad insight into human species that occurs.
There was another observation you made that kind of speaks to that. You talked about how after a while, when you lie to the public, correct me if I have this wrong, when the public is lied to so often, you start to have contempt for them because they believe it. And yeah. There was a passage where you talk about how, well, because they're just mentally not up to it, they should just leave it to us. Right. And that's the mentality that starts to be developed within, you know, in this sort of secret world. Yeah. It sounds like it's sort of a self-perpetuating cycle. You know, you lie to the public, they believe it, and then you have more contempt for them. So you lie more and
you're justifying lying to them.
Yeah. Well, you know, yes, another short answer, but, Matt, let me put, you remind me of your very good work in the past. It's not only the government that does this. In fact, who pretty much is the audience, the people who determine our foreign policy or very much of our policy. We're talking about corporations here who are as secretive as the government without having a formal classification system. They don't have clearances that the FBI goes into. They don't stamp things top secret. They probably stamp them sensitive. Or eyes only, or you know, corporate use only. They sign non-disclosure agreements, which are exactly the same as the secrecy agreements we do in the U.S. So you made the point of focusing on specific financial empires like Goldman Sachs, you know, the vampire spin. Squid, okay. That is not done as it should be in discussion of foreign policy and of big policies like climate. You can read, you see back of me here, a library of books on nuclear dangers, nuclear arms control. If I picked out a book on that, if I picked out 100 books, I could look in the index and not see the word Boeing or Lockheed or Raytheon or Northrop Grumman or General Dynamics. Just not there. They are people, you know, who they build things that we want, you know, when we ask them to do it. It's not. It has no relevance that they are picked to be SecDef, Secretary of Defense, or Deputy, or Assistant, and whatever. Lockheed, Raytheon, our current man is just from the board of Raytheon right after he got out of the Air Force. And, of course, out of the Army, I'm sorry. And, of course, the prospect of going onto the board of Raytheon and General Dynamics is critical to importance when they talk about the weapons they need. Mattis, for example, James Mattis, said when he had been head of the Strategic Command, which is the successor to the Strategic Air Command, when he was out of it at Stanford for a while, he said, "We don't need the third leg of the triad. We don't need ICBMs," which I was talking about earlier. And he'd been in charge of the ICBMs. No, don't need them. We shouldn't have them. Then when he's going for a committee to be confirmed, he says, "Well, it's a question of whether we need them. We ought to look into that." When he's actually Secretary of Defense shortly after, "Oh, absolutely, we need the triad, no question about that. We need the ICBMs, they've served us well in the past. After all, we haven't had a nuclear war, right?" So it's just like, I think we can assume that Austin, the General Austin now from Raytheon, who knows nothing about ICBMs, let me just guess that, he knows as much as your audience knows about nuclear winter. We haven't heard from him. If he doesn't come out for Northrop Grumman's ICBMs, I'll be amazed. I'll eat your hat, your TK hat there. No, that's his job. So it is important. No, take climate. Bill McKibben, great expert on climate, one of our best voices on the subject, just had a very good review of a book by Bill Gates on climate. And he gives the book some in the New York Times book review section about a week ago. It's a very good review. People should look at it. He says, yeah, he's right about this and this, and he's got some good things here. But then he says, but he's ignoring various things, and he goes into criticism. And he brings out the point rarely made that people concerned about the climate should turn their attention to the vested interests that maintain the status quo of putting fossil fuel out of the ground and into the air and causing greenhouse gases. Okay, so he says, the fossil fuel industry, you know, is of a major importance here. And I looked to see the name Exxon, but it wasn't there. Or Gulf, or, you know, ExxonMobil, British Petroleum, and so forth. We have got to see the power behind the throne here at last. And in theory, Congress could bring them to check. A little harder to do when they're essentially paid in office, you know, with their campaign contributions and the votes and the jobs that are involved in the thrall of these companies. So is it impossible to change that? No, it's not impossible. It's very difficult, very hard, very unlikely. It's worth doing. And just as you, now, let me ask you, Matt, how much your expose of Goldman Sachs? Okay, if I'm not mistaken, Goldman Sachs just transferred their offices into the White House after you'd written that. Am I wrong?
Multiple times,
you had,
yeah.
You had administration filled with Goldman Sachs people, and that was true of Barack Obama. Am I not wrong?
Yeah.
As much as anybody else. In fact, I think Goldman Sachs was one of Barack Obama's major contributors.
It was his number one private contributor.
Actually. Okay, number one.
Yep.
So I suspect, for example, that what they saw in what he described himself as this thin black guy with a funny name, what they saw in him as early as before he ran for the Senate, when they were already backing him, was somebody with their interactions with him who would not nationalize them when the 2008 bubble burst. They could see that coming. Surely, you know, as I think you exposed, Goldman Sachs was short selling short stocks. They were selling, you know, to their customers.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So they could see it coming. Okay. And their secrecy, did that leak out? No, not because they had top secret, but because their careers depended on not leaking that out, people who knew it. Okay. So they needed several things from a new president when that bubble would burst. He wouldn't nationalize them. He wouldn't penalize them criminally. He would reimburse them. He would make them good, as they did, Goldman Sachs. And Barack delivered on all that. What else is needed? So these are the connections that investigative journalism and Congress, if they conducted hearings appropriately. Let me ask you, Matt, you know, and I don't know, were there adequate or even any kind of hearings on the 2008 financial? I'm sure there were hearings.
And there was the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, which was pretty detailed and did a lot of great work. And then there was the Dodd-Frank bill where they talked a lot about the 2008 causes. But
how much has changed, would you say, as a result? I'm asking. I don't know. That's not my field.
Not too terribly much, unfortunately. And it's sort of much the same story. And the rescue of the COVID economy is very similar to the bailouts after 2008 as well. So the banks had a great year last year. They had one of their best underwriting years ever. So in the middle of a pandemic. So as you say in your book, nothing much changes.
Yeah, which coincidentally is Biden's one of his most kept campaign promises, although he didn't make it publicly. He said to a bunch of donors, nothing would fundamentally change.
That's right. I did hear that. Well, that's not a wonderful thing.
Well, that was great. Really interesting,
that
right?
That was extremely interesting.
And if you liked that interview, you can hear the rest of it because we barely scratched the surface. But you can hear the rest of it at usefulidiots.substack.com.
And thanks so much for checking in. And thanks so much for listening to this new Useful Idiots Unchained.
It was our first Useful Idiots 2.0.
Useful Idiots with a Vengeance.
Yeah, it is. It's the comeback tour. They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. I know that's one of Matt's favorite quotes.
It's
on a lot of college posters. They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were on Substack.
Right. We were subseeds.
Yeah, they tried to bury us. They didn't know we were subseeds. And of course, subscribe to usefulidiots.substack.com and you can hear the rest of our great interview with Ellsberg.
Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.